This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Aeon Woo. Her book is called The Great Divorce, A 19th Century Mother's Extraordinary Fight Against Her Husband, the Shakers, and Her Times. It's a really interesting book. Hi, Aeon. How are you?
Great. How are you doing?
Good. So, you know, I think probably I'm safe to say that the vast majority of people who are alive today have no clue who Eunice Chapman was,
mm-hmm.
who's the your 19th century mother. The story of your book takes place in the early 19th century. It's about the teens, almost 200 years ago, and maybe you could talk a little bit about the background of the story, and then we can go on from there.
Yes, well, Eunice Chapman was an extraordinary woman who took on her husband, the Shakers, and really the law and the very fabric of her culture and her fight to recapture her children. What happened was that her estranged husband, James, basically ran off with her three children. And these were children who, by law, really legally belonged to him. She was not in any position to fight back, and she did, and that's why she's remembered today. She used everything within her power in this fight for her missing children.
And the the background is that the Shakers at that time were a fairly large, obviously not as big as mainstream religions, but they were a not a small group. They had a number of settlements, and the Shakers today are famous for their the physical culture, the products that they made, beautiful furniture and kind of home goods. But really what was going on at that time was that they were preaching a kind of radical form of Christianity.
Yes, very, very unusual. I mean, today, as you said, David, we think about the Shakers in terms of, the oval boxes, the straight-back chairs, all these beautiful products that they make. And I think they've very much become idealized in our culture. I think about the fact that for example, Barack Obama became president to the tune of a Shaker song, Aaron's Simple Gifts, which is John Williams' riff on the Shaker song Simple Gifts. When we think about the Shakers, we think about things. And back then, the Shakers were kind of going through a transition. They were, on the one hand, greatly appreciated for the things that they made, their produce and all these their charitable works. But they were a radical religious society, and they were greatly feared by many because they did have some pretty unorthodox viewpoints and requirements. In order to be a Shaker, you had to renounce anything that really tied you to the world, all exclusive bonds, and that includes property, your family bonds, and also probably most famously your sexuality. And because of these unusual practices that they had, the Shakers were often seen with a great deal of skepticism and even fear. And I think Eunice Chapman's story really kind of put a spotlight on those the less usual elements of their society.
And she was not the only person of her time who had conflict with the Shakers. I mean, the fact that she was is even known today is in part because she wrote.
Mm-hmm.
She used writing as a tool to fight the Shakers' power over her children.
Mm-hmm.
But you document in your book that there were a number of other people, and in fact she knew some of them, and they kind of, almost informally communicated as a kind of, today it might be a Facebook group,
yeah.
The anti-Shakers, but
yes.
like a support group that she built to help her. And she did take advantage of the hostility and fear that existed in the culture toward, the Shakers as evidence of unusual belief systems. I think at that time there were other groups that were looked at kind of askance by people, and they're not necessarily knowing what was really happening, but this idea that, first of all, they would you gave up all your worldly property, you would join as a kind of commune.
Mm-hmm.
The Shaker group, and then they had villages, which were, in fact, very well put together, and well done. They worked really hard.
Yes.
They were successful on the one hand, and they were respected by many people in the society simply because they were well-behaved, well-organized. And, of course, the Constitution of the United States was a relatively new document at that time,
mm-hmm.
and people were thinking about freedom of religion in a very powerful way because they had fought the Revolutionary War only 40 years before to free themselves. That's kind of the basis of America. It was much, we still believe in it today, but it was clearly fresh to
mm-hmm.
them. So there you have a conflict when she's trying to enlist support of the society against the Shakers. She runs up against a very powerful feeling that they should be tolerated.
Exactly. I mean, this is an issue that people are talking about very much right now also. On the one hand, our Constitution defends the freedom of religion, and the Shakers and every other religious group have every right to practice as they please. But the issue that Eunice Chapman made of the Shakers at the time, looking at the New York State Constitution, which stated that acts of licentiousness or anything that endangers the state, any kind of religion that endangers the state, needed to be controlled. Eunice really raised a lot of questions about, this is a religion, but what kind of a religion is it? And does it threaten women and children, for example? Is it something that the state needs to intervene with? And when she did that, she raised a lot of questions about the Shakers' beliefs, their religious practices. And as you said, these ideas are very fresh, and the defense of civil liberties and religious rights were very important in this era as they are now. So people really used this case to talk about very pressing issues that were not yet and still remain unresolved.
But in the kind of history of the social evolution of the position of women,
mm-hmm.
It's also important in your book, I think, that you provide this context that at the what it was like for women, and of course what it was like for men at that time, but that women were first of all, they didn't have the right to vote, and that was far off. It was 100 years later that happened. But when they married their husbands, they lost their identity, which I thought was really an amazing idea.
Yes. Well, no, I think the interesting thing for me throughout this research process has been, when we think of lack of rights and lack of civil rights, naturally we think of slavery, which was a terrible situation in the early 19th century and beyond. But what surprised me, I think, when I began this research was to see that married women, women who were allowed to enter the contract of marriage, and of course that didn't include everybody, that only included free women, married women were also lost their civil rights upon marriage. And this is a situation that would not change for decades in the country. So when Eunice Chapman went to look for custody rights and a divorce, she was really fighting a system that was very much set against her.
And it was difficult, a hugely difficult process for her. I was impressed by, the difference between then and now. If you think 200 years ago, travel was slower, communication was infinitely slower.
Mm-hmm.
It took her years to do what she did, which was, the thing was that after her husband took the children and joined the Shakers, and it appears from your research that the Shakers really did collude with the father to keep the children away. And initially, they tried to bring Eunice into the fold. Their principle was stated that they really didn't want couples who were not both going to become believers.
Yes.
But if it didn't happen, they felt obligated to take care of the believer, in this case the husband, and they protected him, and of course they wanted converts, so they wanted those three kids.
Yeah, it was very complicated for the Shakers, and the thing is now, when we look at the Shakers and their practices towards children in the 19th century, again, much of their behavior is idealized, and for good reason, because the Shakers, before there were state-run orphanages, really did provide a haven for many children as well as for women. But that actually happened later, in by the middle of the 19th century. When Eunice Chapman was facing Shaker society, this was a time when the Shakers themselves hadn't really worked out what they were going to do with children. The goal really was not to bring in children who could very well grow up and leave the society, and that happened more often. The goal wasn't to bring in youngsters who hadn't made up their minds yet, but to bring in real believers, people who had already experienced life outside, seen what it was all about, and decided for themselves that Shakerism is what they wanted. That would be somebody like James Chapman, Eunice Chapman's husband, somebody who embraced the faith, embraced the religion, and decided, yes, I want to commit myself fully to this way of life. Now, the problem happens when such converts came with husbands or wives or children or all these other family members who would have to be renounced. And in the Shakers' favor in this particular case, I mean, James Chapman was not in a very good position, or not a very good husband either, before he encountered the society. In fact, you could argue that the Shakers really did help him become a better man. He was alcoholic, he was abusive, he'd actually abandoned his wife and children, expecting never to come back. But it's really the Shakers who turned him around, and they showed him that he couldn't just abandon these dependents, and that he had to do something to help them before joining their world. And the irony, of course, is that he comes back and there's probably much more misery and tension in many ways between Eunice and James, and also with the children, than if James had actually stayed away. So one of the things that's interested me most about this story is that there isn't any real easy good guy or bad guy.
What I thought about was the paradox, mm-hmm. that, in fact, the Shakers are founded by a woman,
mm-hmm.
Who was very, in a sense, there was a kind of protection of women as an undercurrent of the Shaker belief system, because they were so abused by, you know, this notion of being subservient to the man,
mm-hmm.
that in fact, the founder of Shakerism is kind of escaping the misery of married life and, you know, throwing off the bonds of the material world. It's a way of saving herself.
Exactly.
And here then comes Eunice, you know, some years later. And meanwhile, there are quite a few women with strong positions of authority and power within the Shaker religion, which is very unusual at that time.
Yeah, exactly. In the rest of the world, women, you know, as we discussed, married women were considered civilly dead. Within the Shaker world, women were not considered second-class citizens. They were right up there next to the men. Women occupied positions of leadership, and this was actually a result of the Shaker celibate lifestyle. You have, the men and women weren't cloistered. They lived in the same buildings, but they did sort of operate independently. And you needed to have a woman leading the women and a man leading the men. And so all the way from the first ranks of authority, all the way up to the very top, there were women alongside the men. And in fact, at the time that Eunice Chapman fought the Shakers, there was a woman at the helm, just like Mother Ann Lee. And this was a woman named Mother Lucy Wright, who actually had a good deal in common with Eunice. So again, the irony is just abound.
Yeah, no, that makes it a kind of, you know, much more complex story. And then there is the fact that Eunice, who would do anything to get her children back,
mm-hmm.
at that point. There are all kinds of suggestions about her being somehow licentious and how she was able to convince, and she didn't go to court to get her children back. I think the idea being, as you said, that she would probably lose, but it would have been expensive and very time-consuming.
Yes.
And because she was able to connect to the New York State Legislature,
mm-hmm.
the alternative at that time, which was probably maybe not more common than it is today, go to the legislature and ask for a special bill.
Mm-hmm.
And she did do that, and you did describe a lot of the process that involved, which is kind of gets us into a very rich portrait of a state legislature early in the history of the United States. It was a very different environment, you know, in much smaller communities where people, you know, you would see them on the street and people would talk to them in the, you know, the legislators would hang out in the local taverns. They didn't have offices.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was really interesting. And, of course, then she spends years getting this a bill passed. Then it gets overruled then or vetoed, and then she has to come back and do it again. But eventually she does succeed.
Yeah, she does, and when you think about what she faced legally, it's just absolutely extraordinary. The reason why she went to the legislature is because the laws at the time were completely inefficient. There was no way for a woman in her position to apply for custody of her children when she first began fighting for her children in 1815. There was nothing in the laws that spoke of a mother's right to custody. The father's custody was so much presumed. And as far as divorce is concerned, she had been abandoned, she had been abused, all these things. You would think that that might be a good reason for her to qualify for a divorce, but in fact, adultery was the only grounds considered for ending a marriage. There was a legal separation, which was possible, but that would still leave Eunice, you know, halfway tethered to her husband and also unable to marry again. So for her to go through the normal legal channels, I mean, she couldn't. She could try to get a divorce, but that would get her nowhere as far as custody is concerned. She was really, her case appeared on a real cusp in American history where divorce and custody rights had not yet been fully thought through, and she challenged them all.
And it took a while after this. I mean, it wasn't that her case, in fact, literally was a landmark and changed things. It really is, you know, a marker along the way, but it took many, many years
mm-hmm.
for kind of family law to evolve and for women's position to be recognized and for that to then be reflected in the laws and in the mores of the culture. Even, you know, it wasn't that long ago when most states would not allow divorce unless there was adultery on one side or the other.
Yes.
And which is why a lot of people went to places like Nevada to get divorced. That was going on, you know, only 50 or 60 years ago.
Exactly. I mean, divorce mills, there have been various divorce mills over history. In Indiana in the 19th century, Nevada, as you mentioned now, and in New York State, actually, adultery was considered the only grounds for divorce until 1966. You know, very, very recent history. And in fact, unilateral no-fault divorce was just signed into legislation in August of 2010. So New York has been conservative for a very, very, very long time. And the fact that Eunice was able to get a divorce immediately against her husband without a trial, without any kind of wait period, and on grounds other than adultery, abandonment, or cruelty, which were the grounds until very recently in New York history now, and it just shows how truly exceptional and extraordinary she was.
Well, and part of her exceptionalism is the business of writing
mm-hmm.
pamphlets, which I think she wrote several. And I'm kind of curious about that. I know you've read them. How's her writing? You know, I know it's of that period, too. We're talking about the early 19th century, so the style is completely different from the way we write today or even 100 years ago, but was she could she write persuasively?
Well, she was no Shakespeare, but she was very, very clever, and she exploited the familiar genres of the time, and that meant sentimental writing, captivity narratives. Slave narratives didn't reach their peak yet at this point, but she sort of anticipated that also. She really sort of reworked all these genres in her favor. Now, the style to us seems really kind of over the top and too melodramatic, I would think. She has all these exclamations, and she, you know, she cries, weep, weep, and she says, you know, I'm my tears are falling on the page as I'm writing, all this kind of stuff. Nevertheless, despite that sort of over the top quality, there is a very powerful undercurrent of pathos, of anguish that really comes through even now. And I remember when I first read her narratives, I was sitting in front of a microfilm reel because these books are pretty rare now, and I felt like she was reaching out to me, and that's how she made people feel at that time so powerfully with her writings, and that's really why she was able to achieve what she did. I mean, lawmakers would say over and over again, why are we considering giving this woman rights and a divorce when it's a complete exception to our laws? Why this woman? Why now? And the answer really does have to do with her writing. It was that powerful.
Right, and she passed these out to all the legislators, so they kind of, and you can see them kind of going to their desks and picking up this thing and then reading it.
Mm-hmm.
But she also sold them and passed them around the countryside?
Yes, she did, and she was a self-published woman. I mean, she's the one who really, she had to finance everything. She had to get subscribers. I mean, it was very difficult to get published at the time. This was decades before the advent of the penny press, so it was very, very expensive, a very arduous printing process, and yet she managed to do what would become quite popular in the decades to come, to sell her story and make that part of her case.
Right, so I think that's actually interesting for today, too, that the idea, the power of writing,
mm-hmm.
in terms of influencing people. I mean, oratory does as well, and clearly, today we have television, but in that era, it was either oratory or writing,
mm-hmm.
that could convince an audience and gain you the political will that was needed. And of course, as you mentioned, they probably weren't really kind of legal in the way that they supported her. I mean, she used a lot of the bias and mistrust of the Shakers to her advantage.
Right? Yeah.
She was willing to do anything at that point.
Exactly.
And so after she gets custody, I mean, there, the scenes you paint of her, going finally to get her children.
Mm-hmm.
They've been in the Shaker Society for several years by now, and she was sort of shocked when they were presented to her and not really all that happy to see her and not really all that unhappy to be Shaker.
Yeah, and for me, that part of the story was really the most heartbreaking. And I mean, she lives about 3 years without knowing even where her children are for years. And when she finally does set eyes on them, 3 years is a long time in the life of a child, especially when you're thinking about ages 5 to 8. And it was a very, readers can read for themselves, but it was a very painful reunion, and the whole last part of the story, you would assume that she has this legal victory and then it's done. But as you mentioned earlier, travel wasn't so easy at this time. The country was unmapped and very large, compared to the distance that people could easily travel. Eunice still didn't know for sure when she had her legal victory where the children were. They could have, Shaker villages, they had them in Kentucky and Ohio and Maine and New Hampshire, and it's not like she could call them up and ask whether her children happened to be there. She'd have to really have some hard evidence that her children were at one of these places and then go after them. Even then, she wouldn't know for sure that children could be moved just as they had been before. So there was a lot of uncertainty, and I think that's part of what makes for a very dramatic ending.
Well, you've done a lot of research in this book, and I know you went to original sources, but it's not just a flat retelling of her story. You kind of bring her to life, I think, as a character. It's hard to know her, obviously, but I think you've done a really good job of capturing her. And also not over, over praising her, if you will, because she is actually just a person, not she didn't become a political hero in any way. In fact, after she got her children, she pretty much was satisfied. She didn't need to be political anymore, and she went on about her life.
Yeah, she was fighting. She had one goal, as she told the Shakers, and she has this harrowing letter where she threatens them, but she points out, if you will give me back my children, I will be done with you. I do not want to spend the rest of my life fighting with you. That's not the goal here. The goal is to be reunited and move on, and that's what she did, for better or for worse. She didn't help out. She did help out Mary Dyer a little bit, but she didn't make it her life's crusade to actually had when she didn't know where her children were.
Right, she was wanted to destroy them.
Mm-hmm.
It was really a tool to
mm-hmm.
get her children back. She gets her children back, and at that point, okay, I'm done with this crusade. And probably good for the Shakers because they would be
yeah.
happy to be done with her.
Yeah.
You know, they were not very pleased to be pulled into all of the things that she, you know, that she was like a devil to them.
And it was a real danger for them, too. I mean, the kinds of abuse that they faced, the rights that they were very nearly deprived of. You know, I mean, they went through hell on her account. But in some ways, you might say, too, that she indirectly improved their society because she made them rethink some of the discrepancies that they had in their policies, which were really a reflection, I think, of the very laws of the times. I mean, I don't think the Shakers are entirely to blame for these disparate practices. The rest of the world, or at least the rest of this particular culture, was the same way.
Right. No, that makes sense. And then, you know, you kind of as the coda to the story, you talk about her. I mean, she had a very long life, and her son kind of became a wealthy, dissolute guy. But you know, the family just went on and became regular citizens.
Mm-hmm, and more. I mean, I think there are a lot of, the ironies continue to the very end, I think, when you look at what became of her children. And I think it's safe to say that they probably did better, well, with one exception, not being, it didn't seem like Shaker's life was suited, particularly well suited for any of them.
Right. Well, it's hard, you know, that's a really hard judgment to make, I think, and probably even they might have had some, confusions about whether, you know, who they were and what were, you know, what was the right thing for them.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a great story, and I really really enjoyed it. It's an amazing amount of research and work you did on a, you know, because this is a period of time when there really isn't a great written record for a lot of the stories that you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
This has been Writer's Cast. I've been talking to Lilian Wu about her book, The Great Divorce, A 19th Century Mother's Extraordinary Fight Against Her Husband, the Shakers, and Her Times. It's basically a portrait of Eunice Chapman, and I think very well done. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much.